Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, 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 maybe the naysayers were right after all. We learned this morning the economy slowed but did not stop in the first quarter, so technically it's not a recession. But if that's true, then why is the Fed still cutting interest rates? We bring you a tale of two economic indicators today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, serving their audit, tax, and advisory clients worldwide with people who love what they do. Online at grantthornton.com. And by gather.com, where friends can stay in touch. People are talking at gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to the end of April. It is Wednesday today. Not just any Wednesday, though. We got a nice look in the economic rearview mirror from the Commerce Department first thing this morning, and then the considered professional opinion of the Federal Open Market Committee this afternoon. First things first, though, the economy grew at a rate of 0.6% January through March, exactly the same rate of growth as the fourth quarter of last year. Not to get all wonky on you here, but the old school definition of a recession is two quarters of negative GDP in a row, which would seem to settle the debate over the R word for now, at least. But then this afternoon, the Federal Reserve did exactly what everybody thought it was going to do, cut short-term interest rates a quarter of 1%. And in the process, said some not-so-reassuring things. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has the story.
Justifying its seventh rate cut since September, the Federal Reserve said economic activity remains weak. The board acknowledged that inflation has been on the rise in recent months. Fear of inflation prompted two of the 10 board members to vote against another interest rate reduction. But economist Jack Albertine says a majority still have faith the economy will take care of inflation by itself.
The Fed believes that inflation's not going to get out of control as long as the economy is limping along at the kind of rate we're seeing. So I don't think the Fed is overly concerned about inflation. I do think that they're worried that the economy could deteriorate further, and that's why we had this interest rate reduction.
Inflation hawks had hoped for a signal the Fed is now ready to pause its rate reductions. Instead, the Fed left the door open for more cuts in the future. But Diane Swonk of Mizero Financial sees some subtle hints that this may be as far as they'll go.
The Fed is not as worried going forward about the economic weakness persisting as much. The downside risks have sort of been dropped a bit. And the Fed also really emphasized how much they've already put into the system. So there's sort of a sense that the Fed is shifting gears here. It's one step towards a pause.
Despite signs of inflation, especially in grocery stores and at gas pumps, analysts say the Fed's number one worry is something else. They say the Fed fears the banking system hasn't finished unraveling in the wake of the subprime mortgage meltdown. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
We'll get to Wall Street and today's cuts at the usual time, but let me detour into foreign exchange for a minute here. There had been some hope that a strong statement by the Fed that it was done cutting would bump the dollar up from its near-record lows. The greenback did fractionally better against the euro today, but nothing like what was expected. Omer Essener, senior market analyst at Roush International, explains why.
That's why we're seeing the dollar sell off initially here. I think the market was looking for a little bit more of a kind of a concrete type of statement that indicated that we are at the end of the Fed's cutting cycle. We didn't get that, and I think that's the reaction to that positioning of the market ahead of the Fed meeting.
You talk dollar these days, you talk oil. Crude fell today on rising U.S. supplies. $113.46 a barrel was the close. Corporations are subject to some of the same economic stresses the rest of us are, and just as our bills are getting a bit steeper, so are theirs, especially companies that sell food. Kraft and Kellogg reported lower profits today, but they still did better than anybody was expecting. From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains.
Let's use a box of macaroni and cheese as an example. Everything that goes into it is getting more expensive. The wheat to make the macaroni, the milk to make the cheese, the gas for the truck that brings it to the supermarket. To make up for all those extra costs, the manufacturer charges you, the consumer, more. Tim Ramey follows the food and beverage business for D.A. Davidson. He says fortunately for companies like Kraft, Kellogg, Procter & Gamble, and the rest, we still have to eat.
We just change how we eat it and what we eat, but we don't change the quantity of what we eat. Otherwise, we would all collectively lose weight every recession, and that never happens.
Ramey says when food gets too expensive, the first place consumers cut back is on luxuries, like meals out. That hurts the food companies, too, because they supply a lot of the stuff you find in restaurants, like salad dressing or bread. The consumer's next step is usually to turn to cheaper versions of the same product. Richard Kilmer is an economist at the University of Florida. He says food companies are worried we'll stop buying their brands, but they still have to make money, so they're trying to work out how much of their costs they can pass on before consumers switch.
They recognize that likely when they increase the price, that the amount that they would be selling will go down. So they have to do it with discretion.
Judging by today's earnings numbers, consumers are staying loyal to their brands. But everybody's expecting commodities prices to keep going up. So better get used to the idea of paying more for that mac and cheese. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The Food and Drug Administration hasn't been having much fun lately. The agency has been blamed for scandal after scandal, everything from tainted pet food to toxic toothpaste. Today, after a little financial help from Congress, the FDA announced 1,300 new hires. That's a big deal for an agency that currently employs about 10,000 people. Jeremy Hobson reports now from Washington.
Former FDA Commissioner Donald Kennedy has been calling attention to the agency's troubles for some time now. Here's how he reacted to today's news.
It's better than nothing.
Kennedy says the FDA still needs more money. Most of the new hires are on the drug side of the agency, pharmacists, chemists, and the like, and about 40% will be paid for by higher industry user fees. Kennedy says that ties the hands of officials.
Not only can you not use much of that money to monitor drug safety, you can't use any of it in the food side of the agency's mission.
The food side is what worries Caroline Smith DeWall. She's the head of food safety at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. She's cautiously optimistic.
The announcement for hiring is only the first step in a long process. They will need much more to see real improvement, especially in the area of food safety.
She says she'd be happier to see dozens of new hires at ports of entry and stations abroad than hundreds of new Washington-based positions. But Assistant FDA Commissioner Kimberly Holden says the new hires go a long way toward keeping the public safe.
A lot of these new staff that we'll be hiring, we will have them out in the field in full force to help conducting the additional inspections that are needed.
Holden says one big problem will be finding 1,300 qualified people who wouldn't rather take a better-paying job in the private sector. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
It took Wall Street a little while to figure out exactly how it felt about the Fed's rate cut today. In the end, didn't much care for it. Put this one in your back pocket, though. April was the first up month for the markets since October. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Treasury Department has decided it needs some more cash to keep the government running. The one-year Treasury bill went back on the market today. The White House had phased it out 7 years ago when the budget ink was black, not red. Wall Street is in a similar boat. The credit squeeze has left the big investment banks a bit short, so some of them have been selling off stock to make up the difference. Last night, Citigroup was the latest to ask investors for a little something extra. Michael Holland is the chairman of Holland & Company in New York City. Mr. Holland, nice to have you with us.
Hi, good to be here. Thank you.
Citigroup wakes up one day, discovers it needs new money. Does it just run out and print new shares of stock and go selling them off to get it?
Well, that's what happened. They announced last night, Tuesday, that they were going to do $3 billion of new capital, which was a bit of a surprise to a lot of people. And this morning, the announcement from Citi was that the deal was not $3 billion. It was, in fact, $4.5 billion because the demand was so strong. And they offered a 4% discount to where the shares had been trading last night, which is not a big discount. So it looks to be all things moving forward in a good way for them.
Good way for Citigroup. But let me ask you this. If I own, say, 100 shares of Citigroup before this transaction, aren't those 100 shares that I have now diluted in the face of this extra sale?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Full disclosure, I don't own any Citi and haven't owned any for a long time. And I know that I, as a shareholder, if I were one of Citi, I would be diluted. In fact, I was surprised that the market's reaction was so benign as it was to the dilution. As you say, the people who are buying the new $4.5 billion worth of new stock have a full piece of the pie, but the people who own Citi before the offering, they own a little bit less of the equity of the company.
But there has to be an upside for shareholders, right? What is it?
The bet from new and old shareholders, for that matter, is that the action itself will provide them with a stronger franchise to make more money in the future having done it. That's why people suffer the dilution and stay with the company, because they say they're doing the right thing, that particularly in these times, companies who are in the financial business have to be strong to compete. If they're not strong, they don't survive. It's very Darwinian right now. So customers, if they can go to J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs, they would go there rather than Citi if Citi didn't do things like this. So it's actually a franchise protecting thing. So if I were a shareholder of Citi, I wouldn't be too ticked off.
You make a good point about the times we're in. In normal credit market times, companies have other options, right? They can float bonds. They can do other things to raise money. Is this equity issue now just the easiest way for them to do this in this tight credit market?
Well, that's a great question. The question is particularly important because in previous cycles where there have been financial turmoil woes, we've had companies unable to raise capital. People just didn't want to take the risk. I believe that the Federal Reserve's action with Bear Stearns and some of the other things that they did have given people confidence to be able to buy whether it's debt or equity of these companies, which they wouldn't have done possibly in previous cycles because the confidence wasn't there.
Michael Holland, he runs the investment firm Holland & Company in New York City. Mr. Holland, thanks for your time.
Great to be with you, Kai.
Those earnings reports from some of the big food companies Elisa Roth was telling us about are great examples of how ripples in the supply chain eventually wind up whacking consumers right in the wallet. In this case, it was rising commodity prices that did it, oil and especially grains. But it's not as if farmers are raising prices just because they can. Often they have to, because their crops depend on the supply of a different commodity. From Wyoming Public Radio, Peter O'Dowd reports.
10,000 feet up in Wyoming's Medicine Bow National Forest, Dr. Chris Heimstra is knee-deep in snow.
Yeah, it's like sugar. It doesn't hold together well.
Heimstra is a researcher at Colorado State University. He and Wyoming's state climatologist Steve Gray skied into these mountains to measure snowfall. Gray says the job of measuring and weighing the snow is vital.
The kind of work that Chris does becomes extremely important for predicting when and how that water is going to come off of this snowpack reservoir and then be available for us to use down in the low country.
So repeat these measurements year after year and you have a pretty good idea how much water is building up in these mountains. As Gray takes me across to the next pit, he says snow is melting earlier across the entire western United States.
We've seen the ground being snow-free on the order of 3 to 4 weeks earlier than we would have expected from historical averages.
Gray says less snow in the mountains means less water for everyone, from homeowners in Phoenix who want to fill their swimming pools to farmers who want to irrigate their fields in Nebraska.
We're really at this crossroads right now where we're going to have to make some hard decisions about the way that we live and make a living.
300 miles and a time zone away, those decisions are already being made. Nebraska farmer Joe Walgren used to grow corn on this patch of land, but less water from the Platte River means he's had to change that.
Our second choice was to choose a crop that didn't require additional irrigation water.
That crop turns out to be alfalfa hay, which brings about $200 an acre in profit.
If I could grow corn right now, I'm looking at a net profit of $600 or $700 an acre.
Walgren and his neighbor Dean Edson are just two of hundreds of farmers and landowners facing similar issues. They compete for water from the Platte River with farms, businesses, and residents, not just in Nebraska, but in Wyoming and Colorado, too. Nebraska only recently thrashed out a water rights agreement with its neighbors. Edson says under that agreement, his state has to retire 75,000 acres of irrigated land.
That's how important water is to this whole economy. But something's going to have to go.
Like the canal that runs from his land to the Platte 6 miles away. In good times, when there's lots of water, this kind of traditional irrigation method makes perfect sense. But as water supplies have become unpredictable, farmers have begun to use water drawn from beneath the ground. Once a subterranean extraction system is in place, Walgren says the water supply is cheaper, more reliable, and more efficient.
Well, no sense in betting the farm on the good times lasting forever. You prepare yourself to experience the good and the bad. You can't say that the good or the bad will be here forever.
Walgren's not willing to write off traditional irrigation techniques entirely. He says snowfall is cyclical, and this year he looks like a smart guy. The Rockies were buried under heavy snows this spring, pushing snowpack levels well above average and raising the hopes of water users downstream.
It's minus six.
So that's maybe about 17, 18 degrees Fahrenheit, something in that neighborhood there.
Up on the hill, scientists Chris Heimstra and Stephen Gray agree it has been a bumper year for snow. But they say it'll take more than one good winter to reverse what looks like a long-term trend. In Laramie, Wyoming, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
Coming up, sex way outside French cities.
Living in the countryside is very lonely. Farmers are often geographically distant from other people and isolated in the middle of nowhere.
But first, let's do the numbers. The stock market danced up in anticipation of today's interest rate cut from the Fed. And then traders read the statement we were telling you about. The Dow quickly gave up its early gains, closing down 11 points, just shy of 0.1% at 12,820. The NASDAQ gave up 13 points, 0.5%, to finish at 2412. The S&P 500 shaved off 5 points. That's 0.33%, wrapped up at 1385. We explained earlier that Citigroup is slicing up its pie into smaller shares. Couldn't help but notice some of that shrinkage today. Citigroup shares lost 4%. Time Warner disappointed shareholders with a 36% drop in first quarter net income. Shares in the media conglomerate lost 2.75% after it announced plans to sell off its controlling stake in Time Warner Cable. That's the country's second biggest cable provider. Bond prices rose, lifted the yield on the 10-year T-note to 3.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. The Energy and Commerce Committee discusses ways to increase broadband access for people with disabilities. The Commerce Department releases personal income and spending figures for March. And 52 years ago today, a polio vaccine created by Dr. Jonas Salk is made available to the public. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Don't let that company name you hear me say every day fool you. Just because we're public media doesn't mean we're not paying attention to the troubles for-profit news outfits are having. The American Society of Newspaper Editors says papers in this country have cut more than 3,600 jobs in the past 10 years, most of them just in the last couple, probably. Electronic media is feeling the pinch, too. All three original broadcast news networks have been laying people off. Commentator David Frum asks whether the future of the news business might not be found in its past.
Ratings are declining and circulations are plunging. Advertising revenues are tumbling. Layoffs, buyouts, marquee properties sold, bought, and sold again. Yet troubled as the news media business is, media as a human activity is pulsing with dynamism, creativity, and invention. There's just one problem. Nobody wants to pay for any of this. Which is why salary journalists are coming to feel like the steelworkers of the 21st century. Perhaps some brilliant person will devise a new model to revive and sustain the big professional news corporation now under so much pressure. But what if it does not work? In that case, the future of the American media may look a lot like the past. A century and a half ago, the American news media were small, polemical, often heavily subsidized by political parties, and relatively poor. Horace Greeley started the New York Tribune with $1,000 in capital. That was obviously more money in 1841 than it is today, but even then, it was not so much money, not the kind of money needed to start a railway or a foundry. More like the kind of money used to start a nice-looking website today. Drop by a successful political blog and you'll notice something. Ads. Lots of ads. But special ads. Ads from political candidates. Partisans give money to politicians who pay money to blogs in order to raise more money from partisans. Again, that looks more like Horace Greeley than like Walter Cronkite's CBS. And even the big media seem to be trending in this direction. Fox News was created as America's first self-consciously partisan television network. The success of Fox has called forth the flattery of imitation from MSNBC. Partisanship makes political news pay. And that suggests that if we're going to continue to enjoy political news, we're going to have to tolerate a more partisan media. It's a grim bargain. But then, our parents thought that having to endure all those Ex-Lax commercials during the nightly news was a pretty grim bargain, too.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. Send us your thoughts. Online is best. Our website is marketplace.org. Farmers have been getting a lot of attention lately for more than just rising food prices, too. Plop yourself down in front of the television tonight. You'll be able to see reality TV's rural answer to The Bachelor when a show called The Farmer Wants a Wife debuts on the CW network. Beautiful women chasing lonely farmers might be new to American audiences, but the concept has actually been cloned from the Europeans. Filming has just started on a third season of the French version. They call theirs Love in the Meadows. Insert your own joke here on that one, but there are more than 100,000 single farmers in France, and John Lawrenson reports they are not amused by their 15 minutes of fame.
Jacques Lagarde knows how difficult it is for farmers to find wives. He's been single most of his adult life. It was easier for his father's generation, he says. There were so many more people about. 20 farmers, men and women, used to work in these fields, he says. Now he's the only one. It's a situation François Purseigle, a sociologist specialized in rural affairs, says is typical and often miserable.
Living in the countryside is very lonely. Farmers are often geographically distant from other people and isolated in the middle of nowhere. More and more, the farmer is a man alone with his tractor.
One in five French farmers are now single. A sad situation for some, to be sure, but also a cracking opportunity to make some very successful commercial television. The rooster crows, the cowbells go, ding-dong. It's Love is in the Meadows. Some amiable but not always eloquent country folk are about to let the television cameras zoom in on their fumbling attempts to find, as a presenter puts it, amour with a capital A.
Je pense que tu es bleu.
Yes, there's weeping amid a good bit of clucking and mooing as a number of young farmers meet a series of women volunteers in a bid to find someone to share their lives and their livestock.
Bonjour.
In this scene, a girl comes to meet a farmer's parents. Everyone says hello, but no one can think of anything else to say. They stand there for an excruciatingly long time while the cameraman just keeps filming. Difficult to watch, but difficult to switch off. And not a super flattering picture of farming folk. The farming unions have, without exception, condemned the show. I meet up with Thierry Gilbert, president of the youth wing of France's second largest farming union, Coordination Rurale, as he's trying to fix a new corn masher to the front of his combine harvester. Mr. Gilbert is, as it happens, single, but thinks the show's an insulting caricature of rural life.
It's always the farmer getting up at 5 a.m, doing this for his cows, doing that for his cows. In one episode, a guy picks up a woman in a horse and cart. This is a completely antiquated image of farming life.
Fremantle Media, one of the world's biggest producers of soap operas, reality TV and game shows, told us they didn't consult farmers about making the programme, but they do give a fair portrayal of modern farming life. They weren't able to reveal the amount of money the show has made them, but confirmed that almost 10% of the population of France were watching it. Back in the hills, Jacques Lagarde wouldn't be seen dead in Love is in the Meadows, but he has resorted to an original and adventurous solution to his long-term celibacy problem. Through a friend of a friend of his uncle's, he's found himself a wife in Ukraine. Valeria Lagarde, as she's now called, plays with a kitten in the little house in the mountains, where she now lives with her sheep-rearing husband.
I was in a big city before, but coming here wasn't a shock. I dreamed of moving to the country. It wasn't easy at first because I didn't speak French, but I love it here.
Jacques' friends say he's a changed man since he met Valeria, much more outgoing. And Love is in the Meadows? Now he can see the funny side. In Verrerie de Mousson, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to cap things off, the untold story of the day is happening in Redmond, Washington. Microsoft's board is meeting to talk about its bid for Yahoo. The Wall Street Journal is reporting this afternoon a decision about whether Microsoft wants to get truly hostile could come this week. Also, that the software company is now willing to raise its offer by $3 or $4 a share. Remember, when that bid was made back in February, it was all stock, and Microsoft shares have fallen by about $3.50 since then. So a bump in the per-share offer would bring the deal right back to where it was originally valued, about $44 billion or so. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow scooted down 11 points, just shy of 0.1%. The NASDAQ fell 13 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 lopped off 5 points, 0.3% there. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, Saudi women have wheels but no license to drive.
I cannot stay like this at home, just watching TV and drinking coffee. It's not my personality at all.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.